Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 135 with the title Resilience, Diversity and Wellbeing. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Sam Rathmang. Sam is a LinkedIn and social selling expert, a cancer survivor and a thriver. When I asked Sam to describe her superpower, she said, "I'm also known as Resilient Rathmang. I've been through so much adversity, and resilience is definitely a superpower." Hello, Sam. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Joe. Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Absolute pleasure. I'm really excited to have this conversation. We met probably 4, 5, 6 years ago, first time at a Professional Speaking Association conference, I think.
We did indeed, yes, I remember it
all. So Sam, tell me a bit more about your resilience, the diversity and the well-being.
Gosh, where do I start? I think we have a lot to cover on our conversation today, but I think a little bit about me in terms of my background. I've been through quite a lot of different challenges, both business and personally, in the last number of years. So I'm a single mom to 3 children. I have an 11-year-old, a 15-year-old and a 17-year-old. All of them have some form of neurodivergence, so I'm quite a champion of that side of things. My son Oscar has ADHD, Asperger's and ODD. My middle child Maya has dyslexia and my youngest child Liliana has just been diagnosed with ADHD. So I have quite a lot of experience working with neurodivergence, particularly within children. I'm literally 1 year on from finding out actually this week was the week that I went to the GP having found a lump in my left breast. And this week that we're recording this episode is the year anniversary of me going to the doctors and then obviously getting diagnosed with breast cancer. So I am now through my chemotherapy, radiotherapy and surgery. I'm on the other side of now my next 5 years of treatment. So obviously that's been a challenge over the last 12 months to deal with. And yeah, quite a lot of different things in business, you know, a few financial issues around businesses, hostile takeovers, you know, just various different things that I've gone through over the years. So I definitely call myself Resilient Rathmang for quite a few reasons.
But just for anyone listening, we're recording this mid-October 2024. Yeah. So I think I remember seeing on Facebook that you were ringing the bell after your last chemo session a few weeks ago. Is that right?
Yeah, it was end of June, 30th of June I rang the bell because the very next day I did the Race for Life. I didn't actually run. I walked very slowly. It was like the last one round and above about 1500, but I still did it. So yeah, so that was a moment though, ringing the bell after all that brutality and what my body had been through. And I think a lot of people think though that the bell ringing is kind of the end, but it's really not the end at all for most people. It's a milestone, definitely, but there's a lot of emotional and psychological trauma that comes with a cancer diagnosis and a cancer journey. So I've still got another 5 years of medication and treatment, and I'm on some quite brutal medication at the moment, which does still mean I'm immunosuppressed and I have to treat it like I'm still in chemo. But the drugs are amazing now and I'm still here, and I'm very grateful that I am still here to share my story and raise awareness, and particularly given that it's October and it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month. So that's another poignant thing. So yeah. Been through quite a lot, especially over the last 5 years, I'd say. They've probably been my hardest 5 years if I look back on my life. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, when you go through something like this, there's a propensity, if you like, to say, wow, you're brave, you've all this. And I've been through phases of my life where people have said, use the brave word to me. And it's well-meaning because it's coming from a position of wanting to say the right thing, wanting to show some empathy, wanting to show some compassion. But when people use it to you, it's kind of like, I'm not brave, I'm just doing what I had to do. Exactly. Bravery is looking back over your shoulder going, wow, that was a journey. You're not brave at the time, are you?
No, I think you are strong because you have no option to be strong, because you literally are just going through the motion. So you have to trust the process. And like for the whole time that from diagnosis to, you know, going through everything, when you're literally your whole life is determined by hospital appointments and waiting rooms and everything gets put on hold, you're just literally, it's almost like being on a roller coaster that you didn't ask to get on and you cannot get off from. And you come off of it again, and then you're just literally thrown into the ether because there is literally no support beyond like the physical treatment. Like the job of the doctors and the nurses and the chemo ward is to get you through that. But once you're through it, it's like you're kind of, the appointments stop and you feel like you're in a safe zone the whole time that you're going through treatment, and you've got lots of appointments because that's what's controlling your life. And then suddenly all of that stops and it's like, okay, what's next? Because now I'm in this, I'm still being treated, but you're not in that, you're not on the roller coaster anymore. You're kind of off the roller coaster, but it's like, okay, what do I do next? And speaking to lots of people that are going through the same journey as me through online groups and physical groups that I go to for support, I find that there's a lot of challenges around people returning to the workforce, like who have been through a cancer diagnosis. And I run my own business, so I've worked all the way through, but a lot of the people I speak to who have been through that journey and then are either returning part-time or full-time to the workplace are finding navigating that particularly challenging, not because of them, but because of the people around them and their colleagues just don't know how to handle the conversation and they don't know how to integrate with that person and speak to that person because of what they've been through. And I think that's a big area that companies need to face up to, given that there are so many people being affected by cancer right now. I think it's a big area that needs to be addressed, because if I was working for a large organization, I had to transition back in. I mean, my own friends don't even know what to say to me. Some of them have disappeared off the face of the planet. That's just what happens. But then coming back into the workplace or coming back in to deal with relationships that you had before you were diagnosed, I think that's a big area for organizations to be aware of.
Yeah, I fully get that. That awkwardness people must feel around you. I guess I'm privileged because I'm the podcast host here. I feel I have a right to just ask questions.
And ask
whereas many people in your personal life are walking on eggshells. Do I say the wrong thing? Do I say, what if I don't know how to talk about it? Do I draw attention to the cancer? Do I talk the brave comment, or what do I know? People walk away because they're scared of getting it wrong, aren't they?
Yeah. They a lot of the time just don't know what to say. So they prefer not to say anything at all. Whereas I'd rather someone just say to me, like, I literally don't know what to say to you, and just start the conversation that way. I get quite a lot of messages. Obviously, I'm on LinkedIn a lot, so I get a lot of messages. But people just going, like, I'm following your story, but I just don't know what to say to you. And I'm like, that's okay. Not many people do know what to say. But at least you've said something versus, completely dismissing you or ignoring you or, only checking in because, I have that, versus, you never check in on me before. So it's interesting the different dynamics that happen around you in terms of, I have best friends that have literally vanished. They don't know how to handle it. And I think part of it is people not wanting to face up to their own mortality, and they just don't know how to handle it. So instead of being there and stepping up, they step away and then they disappear. It's like, where did you go?
Trying to give you space to recover, but not sure how to get themselves back in again, I guess.
Yeah. And I have reached out. I've extended an olive branch to a couple of them who I know, like, they have life going on as well. I get all of that. But you think it doesn't really take much just to drop a text to go, how you doing? But I'd rather that than radio silence. It's interesting.
A friend of mine he passed away, unfortunately, a couple of years ago. Mm. He had intestinal cancer, two tumours. And I went to visit him in hospital in probably the last 3 or 4 months of his life. And I try to be as upbeat as possible, but I also realize that you want to try and find a balance in line between being laughing and joking, not too somber, not too sad, but also respect the fact he was very exhausted. He didn't have the strength to engage in a huge conversation. And it was, I wouldn't say I felt awkward, but I felt it was a really strange situation to be in. And my mother-in-law has been through palliative care, eventually passing away. Mm. My father's in a nursing home at the moment, going through sort of some tricky times. Mm. And it's somehow really difficult to try and find those relatable conversational experiences to talk about that are, yeah, you're worried about your life and I'm worried about the fact it's raining outside. It's a different sort of priorities, isn't it?
It is. I think the best way to handle those is just to ask the person. Everyone's different. And just to say, look, you know, how do you want me to show up today? Because I can be happy. I can tell you jokes. I can make you laugh. I can just be here and not say anything. Like, how do you want me to show up for you today? And I think just asking the person, because they will have good days, bad days, ugly days. They'll have days when they just want to sit and they just want some company. They'll have days when they want to ignore the whole world. So I think it's just about asking that question and just being really open and having that chat with them to see how they want. That's how I would handle it. No, having been on the other side of it, I would want someone to say, you know, how are you really today? And how do you want me to show up for you today? And then it's less uncomfortable.
Yeah, no, I get that completely. Yeah. When you were going through some of this, you must have had, obviously your own mortality came into the front of your mind. You suddenly realized that I'm not forever. I'm a bit broken and I may not get fixed. What were the biggest fears going through your head at that stage? I presume your three children, your business, your family.
Yeah, it was hard. I actually wrote myself a letter. I'm going to get a bit emotional. I wrote myself a letter after I'd been to the doctors and I'd found the lump and I didn't know what it was at that stage. So I didn't know what stage it was, how aggressive it was. Was I riddled with it? Like all these things, like when you're in this limbo period, when you are in the unknown, your brain just goes into this overthinking, the world's going to end, literally your life is going to end and you might only have weeks left. But I didn't know that at that point. So of course, as a single mom, like that for me, my biggest concern immediately around my mortality was like, what's going to happen to the kids, you know? So I wrote myself a letter and I read it back the other day, actually. And it's about 5 pages long and it's all about that. It's all about the fear of the unknown and I don't know what's going to happen and all those kinds of things. And I guess we all know at some stage we are going, we're not going to be here forever, right? But it really does bring it to the forefront. I mean, my family are all over the world. So dealing with this, with my mum and dad in Portugal and my sisters in Australia and New Zealand, like I literally have no family around me, physically around me. They have been in a couple of times over the last year, but I've generally kind of pretty much done it mostly on my own with one or two really awesome friends and my kids. But the biggest thing for me was really the children and like just having everything in place for them. And it really did kick me into gear in terms of making sure that I had and have everything in place for them. Because, yeah, like you literally are staring your own mortality right in the face. And that period of time, you don't know what you're dealing with. All those times when you're in that limbo period, they're the hardest because you just don't have a plan. You don't know what's going to happen next. As soon as I found out what was happening and I had my plan and I'd met with my oncologist and I was like, right, okay, it's going to be this and this and this and I'm going to be okay, hopefully, it was easier. But there was a couple of weeks in that early, literally a year ago, right in this week, actually, a year ago today, was that was all going through my head. So it's very hard.
Did you give your tumour a name?
Yeah, Larry the Lump.
Larry the Lump. Oh, I love it. Is that part of the process where you're encouraged to name it to see your devil or your beast, is it?
I don't think you were encouraged necessarily. There's very little, like, they just give you leaflets. They're like, you have breast cancer. Like, here's some leaflets. Go and read them. It's literally like there's no mental, psychological support unless you go looking for it. There are charities out there that provide it, obviously. I mean, there's some amazing ones out there. But I needed to humanize it and make it, because I told my older kids first when I was being tested, because when I didn't know what it was, I said, look, this is happening for me. I need you to kind of be a bit, you know, flexible with me at the minute. I might not be myself right now. But I didn't tell my little girl, she's 11, but she's got ADHD and she's quite challenged. Like, I'm her world. She doesn't have any contact with her dad whatsoever. So I didn't want to speak to her about it until I knew for sure what I was dealing with. And I called it Larry the Lump when I had that conversation with her, because I literally was like, Larry's going to leave the building. And her defense mechanism is humor. So, which has been amazing because she's kept me laughing all the way through. But she's like, Mom, are you going to have a bald egghead? I'm like, yes, I probably will. I'm going to lose all my hair. And she's like, really? She's like, can I lose mine as well? I'm like, would you do that? She's like, of course I'd do that, Mom. So my two girls actually shaved their hair off. We did a fundraising event for Cancer Research UK and they both shaved their hair off and they're 11 and 14 at the time. And I thought that was amazing. Like my kids just doing that with me, you know, and they're at secondary school. They're not in a school where, you know, that they're that age where image is everything. And for them to do that was amazing. But yeah, I think calling my lump Larry just made it a bit more like easy for me to have the conversation because then it was about removing Larry and Larry went on holiday to America to get tested and packed a suitcase. And we had all those little conversations because they test the tumor to see if you will benefit or not from chemotherapy. So my tumor went all the way to the States to get tested, to get a score out of 100 as to whether or not I would need to have chemo or not. So again, that was an 8-week wait and things like that. Just, you know, you've had the surgery, it's out of your body. Now you're waiting to find out if you're going to go into 6 months of chemotherapy or not, but you have to wait 8 weeks to find that out. So it's those periods are the hardest when you don't know what the next thing is.
What was the hardest thing for you coming to terms with? Was it losing your hair? Was it the surgery? Was it because steroids make you bulk up, change the shape of your face and things? What happened when you looked in the mirror? What were you seeing?
I hate the mirror. I still do. I think the hardest thing for me was the chemotherapy. The surgery I actually liked the surgery because that for me was like the physical removal of the cancer. So I was like, okay, it's out of me now. So that was good. So I didn't mind the surgery. I had a lumpectomy, not a mastectomy. So I went into the consultant saying, take them both off, like get rid of it. Like, you know, just take them both off. I don't care. Like, and she said to me, Sam, let's just take the emotion out of this and talk medical facts and I can save your breasts and give you surgery and radiotherapy and it will have no difference in the outcome. So we decided on a lumpectomy. So I didn't have like major, it was a major surgery, but it wasn't like as big as, you know, taking both of them off. And when it came to the most brutal part of it was definitely the chemotherapy. I was physically prepared for it. I knew it was going to be hard. I knew I was going to lose my hair. I knew all of that was going to happen, but I had no comprehension of just how difficult and what a toll it was going to take on my body, and my brain in terms of my mental resilience that had to go through that. Just the fact that you're literally voluntarily walking into somewhere where you know they're going to inject this awful stuff into you that's going to make you feel so sick and really ill. I put on 15 kilos with the steroids in 9 weeks. It's a lot. My face was all puffy. I lost my hair, like all of that stuff. I'm just so tired all the time. And I've just made a video the other day, actually. It's up on my Instagram, my TikTok, of my kind of year in pictures. It's about a 3-minute video. And you can see the difference in from me from when I first went into surgery to all of the chemo. But I think that I did definitely hit a wall. It was about the fourth round out of six. And I hit a wall and I looked in the mirror and I took a picture of myself. And I never thought I'd share it, but I have. And that picture for me is like the epitome of like the worst time in my life ever. Like I just felt so awful. But I'm through it now, you know, I'm through the other side of it. And I hope I never have to go through it again. But now it's about risk of recurrence and keeping it away. So I'm on lots of different drugs and tablets and medications to prevent it from coming back. So I'm now on hormone treatments and targeted therapy. So I'm on like an oral chemotherapy, but I also have to have 5 years for hormone treatments, which means I'm medically induced into menopause now, which of course brings all of the things that come with that as well, on top of the side effects of the drugs and everything, the other drugs. So it's a lot. But it has meant that I've had to really just handle everything that's thrown at me. And life carries on. You know, I still have to get my daughter to the athletics track 4 times a week and still have to get the kids to school. And I still have to, you know, do life. You can't just put your whole life on hold. So I think the biggest thing for me was managing all of that whilst you're feeling the worst you've ever felt in your life and battling through the whole thing.
Presumably your kids must have matured immensely in the last 12 months, and I would I would like to think, surprised you with their level of maturity that's come out.
Yeah, 100%.
What sort of things have you noticed?
I'm so proud of them. I mean, myself and my eldest son were having some challenges a couple of years ago. I ended up off the back of him kind of going off the rails a little bit, thinking I need to get a handle on him, and decided to go sober. Like, we have that in common, sobriety. So I'm nearly 700 days sober now, which was about 10 months before I got diagnosed, actually. But I have noticed a massive shift in his maturity. You know, he looks after me. He makes me cups of tea without being asked, and he hugs me lots. And, you know, he wasn't hugging me a lot because he was a 16, 17 year old boy, and he was doing his own thing. And whereas he's now a lot more caring, he's got an amazing girlfriend, and I see him being like that with her now, and it's amazing to see him doing that. So I think he's definitely matured a lot, and his perception of the world as a teenager old, you know, 7 year old boy is that everyone's invincible. And clearly I think he realizes now that, you know, not everyone is invincible. But I think his level of maturity has been so impressive, especially with all the challenges he's had in his life, with him being, you know, mixed race, bullied in school, neurodivergent. He's got a lot going on, that boy. And, you know, the fact that he's handled this so well and amazingly has been great. My middle daughter, Maya, she's been an absolute trooper. I mean, my mum had breast cancer when I was a teenager, so I do relate to how I felt. I mean, I literally turned into party girl. Like, that was my way of handling it. I was not there, and I feel bad now because I know what my mum was going through now, and I'm like, wow, I really should have probably been there more for my mum at the time. But obviously she had my dad, and she had a, you know, an amazing loving husband to support her through it. But I kind of went off the rails a little bit, and it really derailed me. And I think looking at my kids, like, that could have happened to them and it didn't. And Lily's just been, you know, my youngest, she just keeps me laughing all the time. She makes jokes out of everything, and she really does bring humor into the whole thing. And she just makes me she'll look at me, and I showed her my picture of my worst day, and she laughed so hard. And I was like, it's not funny. And she's like, but it is, Mum, look at you. So yeah, it's one of those. They all handled it slightly differently, but I'm super proud of all of them. I really could not have got through it without them. Like, they've just been amazing.
Even your worst day, it's better than not having that day at all, isn't it? So
exactly, 100%. I mean, it's so hard because, like, you talk about it and you think, well, I'm so grateful because, you know, my sister lost her best friend to cancer whilst I was being treated. And I had to tell her, knowing that her best friend was dying in New Zealand. And I'm like, it's just, you know, a couple of my other friends or people I know through athletics, they've lost friends. So I know 4 or 5 people that have died from breast cancer who I don't know necessarily personally, but they're connected to my network. And I think, well, I'm still here. And, you know, it's one of those, it's like, I mean, I'm glad I found my lump. I was 47 when I got diagnosed. If I had waited for a mammogram, they don't start screening until 50. I had done a mammogram 2 years prior and it had shown nothing at all. So my tumor had grown very quickly, and I was checking myself regularly because my mum had breast cancer, and she actually had breast cancer twice, and she also had ovarian cancer. She's still here. But everyone I know personally that's had it is still alive. It's the people that have lost people. But for me, I was just like, I need to check myself. And if I hadn't been checking myself, I wouldn't have found the lump. And I don't believe I would still be here. Like, if I'd have waited for my screening and not actually been checking myself every month. So I have it in my calendar. And anyone listening to this, please, please, please check yourselves. You know, there was breast tissue in the breast, in the collarbone, and under the armpit. Like, it's not just the... So go watch a YouTube video and go learn how to check yourself, because it can happen to anyone. Everyone thinks, oh, it's never going to happen to me. But it can literally, it's not discriminative at all. It can happen to anyone. We've seen that with very high profile people, obviously, being diagnosed with cancer over the last year. So, yeah, it's one of those. It's just, I feel, you know, so grateful. And I, you know, you go into the chemo ward and you're in there. It's like a meat factory. There's like 60 chairs in there, and you're literally... you're just like in, and as soon as one person leaves the chair, there's another person in there. And it's just, it's like another pandemic that's not being seen. There's so many people going through treatment or going through cancer. And I mean, just the one little chemo ward that I go to, they see 2,800 patients a month, and they have the stats up on the board. And it's like, wow, like 2,000. And that's just a tiny little, like, I live in Derby. It's not a big town. It's not like it's a town. It's not, it's officially a city, but it's not that big. but 2,800 patients going through chemo every single month in that ward. Like, and you sit there and you're in this, you're not in a private, you know, you're literally in a big bay and there's six chairs over there and six chairs over here and you're literally opposite each other. And you, some people want to chat, some people want to sleep, some people want to just, you know, not be there at all. It's just, it's a quite a fascinating experience to go through it and to really see behind the scenes of what is really happening, you know, in this. It's so many people though.
Yeah. And a couple of years ago, I got the poo test kit through the post to do, and I put it on the side and thought, oh, I'll do this. It looks a bit complicated. I had to get myself in the right frame of mind for it. And eventually, my wife nagged me, Marie nagged me. She said, not nagged me, that's the wrong word, just nudged me and said, come on, do it. And I thought, oh, I'll do it, posted it off. And then Marie got hers a couple of years later, and she, again, I had to push hers because it's a, kind of this reluctance to sort of get yucky with it and dip it into the poo and send it off. And she did it. And then about a month later, one of our friends posted on Facebook that she'd done the poo test and it came back positive. And you suddenly think, wow, I was laughing and joking, that invincibility, it'll just be whatever. And suddenly someone you know does it, and it's an adverse result. And you think, wow, if that had happened in reverse, we found out about her first, I would have just done it straight away.
Yeah.
So we've got to think, it's not only breast cancer. There's
no, all sorts of cancer.
All sorts of cancer.
The main thing is, if anything is unusual to you or not normal, like the best thing to do is just to go get checked, because 9 times out of 10, it's not going to be cancer. It's going to be something else. But if anything is abnormal in your body, like, just get to know what your normal is, because it could be any part of your body, obviously, you know. But things like, you know, when I told my friend group that I had breast cancer, they were like, oh yeah, I should get my, you know, I've been getting those letters to her about getting a mammogram, or, oh yeah, I keep getting asked for the, you know, to go for a smear test or whatever it is, like all these things that you just put off because life is busy. And then it took me getting cancer for my friends to go, oh yeah, I'll book that mammogram now, or I'll go, you know, I'll start checking myself, or, you know. And I thought, wow, if that's just my friend group, how many other people out there are just not, are ignoring letters? I mean, the amount of women I saw in there with cervical cancer that were ignoring their letters, it was, you know, amazing. And one mother and daughter came into the chemo ward actually, and they were in there for the first time. And you can always tell when it's a first timer, because they only let you bring a guest on the first time you go. The other times they're too busy, you can't actually take someone with you. So I knew it was her first time. She said, oh yeah, I kept telling my mum to go and, you know, go for her smear test. And she ignored it for 4 years, and they found a tumour the size of an orange in her cervix. And it's like, she, just because she didn't go and get checked. So if you are listening to this, obviously, like, you know, I'm a big champion of raising awareness, but the earlier they find anything, the more they can do to help you. If you leave it or ignore it or deny it, then it could be too late. So just anything that's abnormal for you on any part of your body, just go get it checked, please.
Yeah. And if you're a man listening to this, yeah, copper feel, you know, it's testicular and prostate cancer, big killers.
I'm talking to both. Men can get breast cancer too. Men can get all sorts of cancer, as can women. So again, it's just copper feel of all your bits. Whatever bits you've got, check them out.
I think you're right in saying, even if you've got like a cyst, and it's only a cyst, get it checked out, go for the mammogram, whatever it may be, and then understand what your normal is.
Normal is, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
100%. I mean, obviously I do check myself all the time, but I just happened to be wearing something different to what I normally wear to go to bed. So I could only find, like, I just grabbed like a really tight white T-shirt. And I'd never normally wear a white tight T-shirt to bed. Like, that's not what I'd normally wear in bed. But I put it on, and then I was lying back on my pillows. I was about 30 degrees. And because I was wearing a particularly tight top, my breast was splayed in slightly a different way. And I was like, oh, what's that? And I just thought, oh, I didn't feel that before. And my tumor was the size of a walnut. Like, it was 2.5 centimeters. And it was right at the very top. But if it had been buried anywhere, if it wasn't right on top of my left breast and it was somewhere underneath, like, I wouldn't have felt it or wouldn't have found it. But thankfully, like, that white T-shirt literally saved my life. But I found it on a Friday night, and of course the GP was closed, and I'm freaking out all weekend, and I'm like, I need to speak to the GP, I need to get to the GP. And I literally rang first thing on the Monday morning and booked myself in that day. And it's a very quick process once they do suspect anything. It's very quick in this country. So I think we're very great, I'm very blessed that we have the NHS, and the staff have been amazing, and once you're in the system and you're going through it, like it, they dealt with it so quickly. But yeah, I just can't thank them enough. I wrote all the staff in the cancer ward and the chemo ward a beautiful poem that they've got in their staff room now. And I bought them in a massive hamper full of like face masks and chocolates and coffee and like all these nice snacks. Because there's so many people in there. Like I've probably interacted with over 200 staff in the journey. So I just felt like I needed to do something for them because they're so amazing.
You mentioned in that you stopped drinking. Mm-hmm. 700 and something days ago, you said, I think.
Yeah.
And what was the trigger? Because I also stopped drinking 1,010 days ago, I think I am now.
Lovely.
Alcohol-free. Just curious about what was your motivation? What waking up with a hangover one day or?
You know, most people do think that it is that, but for me it wasn't. I felt like I had quite a major incident happen with one of my kids. We were away in Bali on holiday and all my children were with me, but one of them had decided in his wisdom that he would give access to my house to all of his mates and all of their mates. And I came back to a crime scene and 27 teenage boys had moved into my property and had destroyed it to the point of no return. And it was awful. And it was just, I don't know why he chose to make the decision to say, yes, of course you can use my mom's house while we're away. But the police raided my house while I was in Bali. And yeah, it wasn't fun. And I got a phone call from the police on New Year's Eve, basically saying there was nothing they could do. They had 4.5 hours in my house, got all the forensics they needed, and basically decided it wasn't worth them spending any energy on it because it was just a bunch of kids and they had access to the house because he gave them the key safe. And I just thought, I have totally lost control here.
And so they didn't break in as such. They had legitimate, they were given access. Legitimate
access. And I got the phone call from the police and I just thought, something's got to change. And I felt like I lost control of a lot of, it wasn't that the only thing, but there were a few other things leading up to it. We had been clashing quite a lot and I just felt like I had no emotional control. And I had noticed I had been drinking more and more to handle the challenging relationship with my son leading up to that. And I just thought, and it was New Year's Eve. And that's the one day of the year when you think that. And I thought, this is going to send me one way or the other. And I had been noticing I had been drinking more and more like on my own in the evenings. And I was using alcohol to dull a lot of the challenges that I was having with that relationship, and which is now amazing. But back then it was really tough. And yeah, I just was like, something's got to change. And I took the call and I knew I was going to hit the bottle. Something needed to change. And I don't know what it was. I don't know why I decided in that moment. It was about 6:30 on New Year's Eve. And I thought, no, I literally have to get control back of my life and back of my kids. And that's when I made the decision to go sober.
Yeah. I think for me, it was just a realization that I've been drinking since probably the age of 13. Many of us drink from our teens, don't we? Mm-hmm. I spent a few years in the Royal Air Force, which didn't help. That was kind of a training ground on how to drink. And I think mm-hmm. that sort of set the pattern. And I was regularly drinking too much from the age of 17 or 18. And in my 30s, I joined a club, and that club heavily revolved around drinking, going out and doing stuff and traveling around. And I think it just became a habit. And I realized I didn't like the person who I was. It was not only my gender transition. I fixed one part of my identity that wasn't working for me. And I realized there was another part of my identity, which is this alcohol dependent person. And I'm not going to debate whether I was an alcoholic or alcohol dependent or just propped up by alcohol, however you want to describe it, but I was certainly propped up by alcohol. And it led me to make decisions I wasn't proud of. It put me in situations I wasn't proud of. It made, rather than go home when the bar shut, I'd be trying to find somewhere to get another drink. I remember being in Estonia on a speaking gig, and we managed to find a kebab shop in Estonia that served alcohol at 4 o'clock in the morning. I was in Melbourne, Australia, and we found a service station. At 5 in the morning, they were selling alcohol in the bottle. And we went to the service station, bought alcohol, and carried on drinking. It was like, you wake up from these things and think, why did I not go to
bed? Yeah, no, I was the same. I definitely resonate with a lot of what you've just said there. I mean, I worked for a drinks company. That was my training ground. Like, I worked for Diageo for 4 years and literally, like, sold alcohol. Alcohol was my life. And I learned how to really cope with drink very, very well. But I had too many moments of bad decisions, blackouts, like not remembering 3 hours of an evening. And I'm like, what am I doing? So I think I definitely was using alcohol to numb the pain of quite a lot of things. I'd gone through a really challenging divorce. I have a toxic relationship with my ex. You know, we went from having a really amicable 50-50 arrangement with the children to me having them 24/7 and him literally disappearing off the planet. So absent father, step, you know, then I'm handling all of that, plus growing a business, plus COVID, plus all these other things. And I'm like, that was my coping mechanism, definitely, 100%. So I resonate with all of that. And I didn't really have a lot of control over that. Like, I would go out, but I'd go out, and I'd really go out. You know, I'd be able to drink a lot, out. And I really be able to drink a lot in an out session. But then I found myself drinking on my own in the evenings and having a, you know, and I'd open a bottle of wine, but the bottle of wine would be gone. It's like, you know, so I feel like it was a combination of things, but I feel much better now that I don't. And I think, well, maybe there's a reason why it all happened now, because 10 months later, I got diagnosed with breast cancer and my liver was probably in the best condition it could be for handling, you know, having to deal with all of that. So I think in some ways, I'm glad that all of that stuff happened, because if I had still been drinking, maybe I wouldn't have found the lump. Maybe I wouldn't have been as aware. Maybe I wouldn't have been able to cope with the treatment and the chemo as well as I did. I mean, I know it was brutal, but, you know, I've come the other side of it and I'm out the other side of it now. But I mean, if anything was going to turn me back to drinking, it would have been a cancer journey and a cancer diagnosis. And I didn't. I haven't touched a drop since then. So I'm quite proud of myself that I managed to handle all of that, all of the chemo and everything without alcohol being at my side, because I think it would have definitely played a part massively if it had been 1 year earlier.
That's quite a thing you're just saying there, that you've come out through this. And you haven't needed to use alcohol as a crutch to get you through that. So if you'd have kind of half stopped or cut down, it would still been in your life. But once you make a decision that it's no longer in your life, it's not the crutch, it's not the support mechanism you turn back to, is it?
No, definitely not. And you know, I have friends that have gone through the same journey as me, and that was their coping. You know, they go in, get their chemo, take the wristband off, go over to the shop and buy 2 bottles of wine and down it, so that they could then like go into a deep sleep for like 2 days. Cause that's what you have to do when you've had chemo. Like, I would sleep for 18 hours, like straight after a chemo session, and just not come out of it. I'd go into my, what I called it my hibernation. But I have friends that would literally go into their hibernation and do it through drinking copious amounts of wine before they went into hibernation. But I think, God, if I'd have actually been still drinking when I got diagnosed, I don't think I would have handled it as well, like emotionally or physically. I think my sobriety made a massive difference to my treatment, I believe.
I mean, I've kept in touch with you mainly from a distance through your social media posts. And, you know, you mentioned your photo montage that you posted recently. And I remember seeing that last week or week before, whenever it was. Yeah. And I was struck with just the power of those photographs, those images, and how... And I don't want to use the brave word, but how it meant something to you to say, this is me, this is who I am, this is what I've come through, and I'm owning this. And I felt a lot of strength in there, a lot of ownership. But you are, yeah, by definition, a social selling expert. And we know that personal brand, how you present yourself on social media, has to have a level of humanity in it. Mm-hmm. And it's not all me, me, me. It's got to be authentic, isn't it? And that's the key we're talking about here.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually did a session with some clients the other day, and we talked about, I gave 13 different words to them that make up the power of a personal brand. And a lot of them are like, well, my content's not working, or I'm not getting much engagement. I'm like, well, score yourself on these things, like score yourself on these 13 words. And one of them was a vulnerability and authenticity. And, you know, it's those kinds of things that draw people towards you. And I thought long and hard about whether or not to share my journey on social media. And I knew I was going to do it in some way, shape or form, because that is part of who I am. Sorry if the dog's barking in the background. There's madness going on outside. Sorry, Joanne. dog it's babies fine. Excited about me being on the show. So yeah, vulnerability, authenticity are key. And the more you can show up as a real human being in through your social media, the more people are going to be drawn to you. I don't talk about everything. I mean, half the stuff I've shared with you on here has never gone near my social media, right? Some of the stuff we've talked about here, I would never in a million years post about. But, you know, I think I did talk to my business partners and I said, look, I really feel strongly about talking about this because I have a following and I have a voice and I feel like I can do some good through the bad, through fundraising, through raising awareness. And okay, I think, well, sure if there's someone there out there that chose not to do business with me because I'm going, is really important because it does draw the right people towards you and it does attract clients and it does show that you are human. And I probably do it not to the extreme, but probably more than most. Because I talk about everything that I've been through, all of the adversity I've been through, my sobriety journey, my cancer journey, my failures in business, all sorts of things. My kids and their neurodivergence, I talk about that a lot. I mean, I did a post about Oscar last week and how he's come through bullying and, you know, through his, you know, challenges through neurodivergence and how our relationship has come through the other side. And that post has had 160,000 impressions, which is a lot on LinkedIn at the moment. The algorithm does not do that these days. And the amount of amazing things that have happened off the back of that one post about his neurodivergence and his differences and his bullying and all of those things. You know, he's been gifted a car by a lady who didn't know me. He's been invited in for 2 days in Google's headquarters to learn AI with Google, which is amazing. And he's been offered mentoring by some incredible, really, really senior people within the AI and generative AI and data compliance. And like, it's just amazing what's happened off the back of just one post on LinkedIn that was me being vulnerable about, you know, diversity and neurodivergence and all these things and racial bullying and things like that. But the amount of amazing, incredible things that have happened to him and to us since we posted about it is amazing. But I could have chosen not to share that, but I felt it was important because his story is very inspiring to a lot of people. And the amount of people that were like, I got bullied, I resonate with it. You know, the lady from Google was like, that's my story and my brother's story. That's how we went through school. And it's incredible when you do share those vulnerabilities and real authentic things about the things that are going on for you and you have gone through, the right people step towards you. And I think it's important that we show up on social, not just as the professional mask, but like actually really who are you? Because that's what really connects us as human beings. And a lot of people forget that behind every social media profile is a real human being, and it's that authentic connectivity that you can get through your posts that will inspire others and inspire them to reach out to you.
I often say to people that the difference between AI writing something and a human writing it is the human has a soul. AI has no soul.
Yeah.
And without getting spiritual about this, you can tell the difference between artificial, because it's just heartless. There's nothing in it. There's no feeling in it.
Agreed.
And we need, I always think inclusion was like that, all about feelings. How we connect with people was all about feelings. And if we're not careful, what we do is we sanitize everything down to what people should see about us and pre-filter everything. So we're almost taking the ability for people to get to know us, and people buy from people, don't they?
100%. Yeah. I mean, I teach this all the time. I mean, I work a lot with salespeople in big corporates and business owners when I'm doing my, you know, training and talking about social selling. And it really is that people are so scared to show up that way, or they just don't know what to post or how to post. And I'm like, just think about just what you champion, like get behind. You probably care passionately about three things outside of work that you would be happy to talk about. So you don't have to share every deepest secret that you've got or everything that's happened to you, but just think about what you can champion. What do you stand for? What do you want to get behind? What do you actually care about outside of you being a salesperson or outside of you being a business owner? Because those are the things, if you can bring them to the newsfeed, they're the things that will connect you with other people, whether it's, I know you're training for a marathon or you're going through, you know, some mental health challenges or you've your kids or whatever it is, like just talk about things that are real and human outside of you being that professional. And amazing things happen when you do that.
Yeah. A friend of mine that I've known for many years, she posted on LinkedIn recently, after a hiatus of about 6 months, that she's got brain tumour. And it's apparently, from what I gather, untreatable. And so she's now living with an expiry date, for want of a better way of putting it. although we all have expiry date above our head, we don't know how soon that is. She's also been through a challenge with a child gender transitioning as well. So there's a huge amount going on in her life, and she's always been very authentic with sharing that side of her. But she gets a lot of trolling and hate and pushback by showing that personal side. Did you get anything pushback to you? You know, that this is not allowed on LinkedIn crowd coming in?
I've never had, genuinely never had any trolling, hate, whatever. I've never had it. My business partner gets it quite a lot, but he's very opinionated and very divisive on purpose on his posts. But I have never had it. I think because of the way that I, obviously over the years, I've become quite a good storyteller. And I think the way that I word things and the way that I structure things in a way that it's not just about that, it's also got lessons or whatever it is in there. I've never had hate on anything, on any social. Like, I've never had to delete comments. I've never had any nasty inbox stuff at all. I've never had any accusations about anything. And I don't know why. I think LinkedIn is quite a professional platform anyway, but it's unusual for you to get that kind of thing. I've never had the whole like, oh, why are you sharing this on LinkedIn? I mean, obviously I'm a LinkedIn expert, so I don't generally tend to get that too much, but I've just never had it. And I don't know why. I think because of the way that my personal brand is, and I give so much value as well around the topic of LinkedIn and social selling, that I think people don't mind me also sharing my other side of things, because I also do it in a way that it is inspirational to people rather than it just being a attention seeking thing. Do you know what I mean? I think I do it in a way that is probably a little bit different to others, maybe. I don't know.
Just thinking about the takeaway from, you know, what are you going to take away from this? What's the impact on you, on how you think or feel or something? Yeah. Rather than just woe is me. Woe is me, and this is how you can.
So I think that's how I always like to angle. I always try and find a lesson or find a something that people can take away from the post that is going to help them in some way, rather than it just being like, this is happening for me, you know? Yeah, I think that's probably it. I don't know.
Yeah. I always remember the broadcaster Chris Evans said, you've got to be kind of Marmite. Half the world's got to love you and half the world's got to hate you. Because once you've polarized people, That sells, you know. People have become raving fans of yours. Yeah. Whereas if you try and be spam and bland and something for everybody, it never quite hits the mark, does it?
No, it doesn't. And I think a lot of people do show up as the boring version of themselves. Like, you know, you meet someone on Zoom or one-to-one, and you think, oh, they're amazing. And then you look at their online social presence, you're like, that's not you at all. Like, that's just boring and dull. Like, why are you not showing up as the, you know, the person that you are? I'm not talking to you directly, obviously, but just when you meet people, you think, wow, like, why are you not bringing that to the, like, that's the person I want to see on the newsfeed. And ultimately, you've got to remember why people are on social. They're usually on social because they're bored or they're trying to sell something for their own selfish reasons. So if you're not entertaining, inspiring, educating, like, you know, they're just going to scroll past you and you're just going to be like in the boringness of most people's posts. And people wonder why they're not getting traction on their posts. It's because they literally are boring. Like, they showing up as the most boring version of themselves. They are.
Yeah. I remember I was doing a pitch to some speaker bookers once. And one of the feedback they got was, they're not sure about me because I didn't come across with any personality. And I thought, blimey. Yeah, normally I ooze personality. I'm kind of jokey. I'm bouncy. I'm all over the place. I thought, you're right. When I was in this mode, my brain was in be professional, be focused, be this, be that. And the only thing I wasn't being was me.
You, yeah.
And it's learning how to just lean back and relax and be yourself. And I found myself doing that more doing online training recently, where I think in the early stages, the COVID days, we were trying to be very professional, very kind of, but now I'm very much more lean back, more relaxed, more comfortable in my own skin. And I feel the difference in me, and I think the audience feel the difference when you can show up like that as well.
Yeah, I think it makes a big difference. Like, how you, the more you are you, the more you show up as your authentic self and not this mask or this professional image that you want everybody. I think that really has, having, you know, done that more and more, obviously, recently, you know, the messages I get or the people that step towards you think, well, anyone that doesn't want to work with you is not going to step forward anyway. And you wouldn't want to work with them. And, you know, if they can't handle you as you are, then why would you want to do business with them in the first place? So I think you attract the right type of people by doing that, and you deflect the people that you just wouldn't at all.
Yeah. I mean, I often think it's my superpower is the ability to polarize people. You know, you either like someone who's trans or you don't. And so I very rarely get people who want to talk to me who don't like me because they don't bother. So it cuts down half the sales process. Half, you know?
Sales process, I love that.
When people want to engage me, they know who I am and they want to engage me. So my job is done. So in a way, it's if you knew what your personality type was that was able to do that with people, if everyone knew, had this little sticker on their forehead and go, this is my type of person, and if you don't like it, go away.
Save yourself a load of time.
It does, yeah. I don't get tire kickers. You know, people don't just turn up and try and or go, oh, blimey, oh, you're trans. I never realised. It's like, oh. So, yeah, I see it's a superpower, and I think owning it.
Yes. Big time.
You just got to own yourself, haven't you?
And own yourself, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely, for sure. And I think that's, if I was to get my kids to, like, I think I've only really got that in the last few years. I think instilling that in my children early on, I'm like, just be you, do you. Even my 11-year-old, like, she's so amazing. Like, her personality is brilliant. I'm like, don't ever change. Like, just be you. Like, you're so brilliant. And she's such a character. And I just never want her to lose that or to feel like she's got to show up any different to how she is. She's like, Mom, if they don't like me, they don't like me, you know. It's just, she's, you know, I was worried about her getting bullied because my son got bullied quite heavily. You know, they're mixed race, she's, you know, she's quite loud, she's ADHD, she's quite disruptive, you know. And I think I don't actually want her to be any different. And if people have a problem, she's like, people have got a problem with me, Mom, that's fine, it's their problem, not my problem. I'm like, yes, this is good. And she's 11, and I'm like, I wish I'd had that confidence and that, you know, I don't care what people think that young, because, and I feel like, I hope I've instilled that in her in the way that I parent her, obviously. But I just think it's brilliant, you know, the way that she shows up and the way that she is being, you know, going to secondary school is a big deal for an 11-year-old. And I don't think she's going to have any issues.
No, it doesn't sound like it. And she's got a fantastic mum who's right there with her as well, and some siblings. So yeah, it's
all the siblings who've been there and done it. So yeah,
it's all, yeah, it's and all. Not only got the t-shirt, they've had the police wrapped.
I know, right? We've had everything. There's not much we haven't gone through together, so it's all good. Why can't we go in the house? It's a crime scene.
Yeah, I mean, the circle of people we hang out with, you know, having a good story is always a good thing.
Isn't it? Know, right? It's always good to have a good story. So
always have good stories. I mean, we first met, I think it was 2018, 2019. I can't remember which one of the conferences it was, but in an hour we've just spent together, I know more about you. You're a fantastic human being that I've loved spending this time with. It's been, I joked with you in the green room at the beginning. I was saying, around about 55 minutes in, I'll say something like, wow, what an inspirational conversation it is. And when we get there, I'll mean it. And I mean it. I absolutely mean it. This has been a really fun hour, obviously some serious topics, but getting to know you better has been absolutely fantastic, and I really appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been great, and I look forward to listening back to the episode.
But how can people get hold of you? Resilient Rattling, where are you, where do you hang out?
Yeah, where do I hang out? Well, obviously I hang out on LinkedIn mostly, so that's going to be the place. There's only two Sam Rattlings in the world and only one of them's a girl. So I'm quite easy to find, really. The other one's a IT CEO in America that won't connect with me.
And your business is, was it Pipeline 44, if I remember?
Yeah, so the company is called Pipeline 44, but we have a couple of brands underneath that. So I look after the Social Selling Teams brand. So I do a lot of work in corporate, working with sales teams, and we have the Social Selling Academy, which is for business owners who want to learn to get results from LinkedIn as well. So yeah.
And you've got a couple of books, and I actually own both those books physically and on and Kindle, I think, because you were doing deals on Kindles. So I've got them both ways. But yeah, you've got a couple of books.
Yeah, so Linked Inbound and Linked Outbound. So they go hand in hand. Linked Outbound is kind of probably more advanced and for people with Sales Navigator and who are doing a bit more kind of outbound and sales and prospecting. Linked Inbound is kind of LinkedIn 101. So if you're brand new to the platform, or you just want to get started, or you just want to kind of really amplify what you're already doing, then LinkedIn Bound would be the place to go. So, yeah.
And they are bestsellers, aren't they? They are.
Oh, yes.
Heralded in the business community as great resources.
Yes, they are. And yeah, I wrote the LinkedIn bound in 2019, but I have a 2023 updated edition. The platform changes a lot, but the methodologies in there don't. So I wrote them specifically in a way that it, whether the algorithm changed or the platform changed, or, you know, it's more about the methodologies behind how you actually build your brand and get results and actually sell on the platform. So, yeah.
But what's next for Sam then? Obviously, Carry On Living high on the list.
Number one, I think I've definitely shifted my priorities in life and my focus, and I've thought long and hard about, you know, I'm very much a go-getter, goal-setting kind of girl. And, you know, this year I'm just like, just get through to the end of the year. My next big thing is I'm heading off to New Zealand and Australia for 4 weeks, which has been the thing that's kept me going through this year, to be honest. All my family are meeting up. My sister's getting married, so I'm going off traveling, taking the kids to go and spend Christmas and New Year in Australia and New Zealand, which would be amazing. And I think for next year, I think it's very much about just recalibrating and getting the balance right on my life, and obviously health being a number one priority, and not sweating the small stuff as much as I used to. I think it's definitely about living for every day and living for every moment, and just not putting too much pressure on myself to achieve all these amazing things that I always have on my goals list. I'm like, just, it's enough right now for me to just be here, be present and have fun and create memories with the children. And that's really my focus right now. And, you know, and obviously get through my next 5 years of treatment, but I'm still here and I'm still kicking, and I can't wait to continue to add value and give back and just help as many people as possible with my knowledge and expertise.
Thank you, Sam. Absolutely amazing. Thank you.
Thanks.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. If today's discussion struck a chord, consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.